This is the November-December issue of Ask magazine, Science and Exploration for Curious Kids. The front cover of the magazine features a wizard and is titled Fairy Tale Science. On either side of the wizard are two scientists working. Page 2. Nosy News by Elizabeth Preston. Squawk? Hello? People aren't the only ones who like to call their friends. Researchers taught pet parrots to video chat with other parrots. The birds loved it. First, a parrot would ring a special bell when it wanted to call a friend. Then its owner would show it pictures of other birds it had met, in person or online. When the parrot pointed to a picture, its owner would call the other bird's owner on a video app. Then the two parrots would have a little chat. Parrots like the company of other parrots. Wild parrots often live in large flocks and spend a lot of time chattering. Some of the birds did video show and tell with each other. Sometimes they sang and danced together. And when a bird disappeared from the screen, its friends sometimes looked behind the tablet to see where it had gone. In the cartoon, Elvis is looking into the mirror and says, "Hello, beautiful." There's a photograph of a parrot looking at another parrot on a video chat call. Antitex. There is a photograph of an anthill. Insects don't have cell phones to find their way around. When ants wander far from their nests to find food, they need to know how to get back. Some ants use architecture to help them. Ants that live in the hot salt flats of Tunisia in Africa have an extra challenge. To find their way home, they follow smells and the sun. They also use landmarks such as rocks. But in the flattest parts of the desert, there might not be any rocks or even a pebble. So the ants build big, tall anthills. The ants use these noticeable hills as landmarks. If the top of a hill gets knocked down, they rebuild it tall. But when scientists added other objects, like rocks, that the ants could use as landmarks, they didn't build as high. Rasputin and Marvin are riding through the desert on their bicycles, and Rasputin says, "Are you sure you saw an anthill?" A true transformer. The new search and rescue star is no ordinary robot. It's a real-life transformer. In rescue operations, robots are often sent into messy places that might be muddy, rocky, or flooded, or all at once. That means the robot might need to roll, crawl, step, or fly to get around. But having separate parts for all these movements can make robots heavy and complicated. The new design is trim and nimble. It has four legs with joints and wheels. The legs and wheels can move into different positions to let the robot move in different ways. It can roll on its wheels, it can step over bumpy ground, it can climb, tumble, and walk. And by swiveling its wheels up to become propellers, the robot can fly. Having multi-purpose parts means less weight, so the robot can fly more easily and go farther on a charge. There are photographs of the transformer in its various shapes. Rasputin says to Marvin, looking at their bike that's all messed up, "I wish I could transform this back into my bike." I'm going to skip Nestor's dock and turn to page 6. Fairy Tale Science by Charlene Brusso, art by Dave Clark. Could anyone really sleep for 100 years? Dance in glass slippers? Get gold eggs from a goose? Hundreds of years ago, the idea of seeing pictures move, talking to someone far away, or flying to another city through the air would have sounded like pure fantasy. Yet, now people do those things all the time. Science has made these dreams real. Could it someday grant other fairy tale wishes? Zia says, "Please is my magic word." Sleeping Beauty Have you ever wished you could cast spells? Just say something and have it come true? Maybe it's just as well we can't, or the next time you have a marathon burping contest, your sister might put you to sleep for 100 years, like Sleeping Beauty. Could anyone really sleep for 100 years? Probably not. The daily cycle of sleep and waking is programmed into every cell in your body and is hard to change. But some animals do take very long naps. Bears, groundhogs, mice, and snakes can sleep for months at a time when they hibernate through the winter. A hibernating animal slows down its breathing and heart rate, lowers its body temperature, and doesn't eat or drink. Then, when the weather warms, it wakes up. Seeds and some tiny insects can dry themselves out and remain dormant for many years at a time. If scientists can figure out how animals hibernate, maybe one day people could hibernate too. This would be great for astronauts who could sleep through long space voyages. Hibernation tricks might also help doctors slow disease. But even hibernating animals still grow older. So if a future Sleeping Beauty ever did manage to hibernate for 100 years, she might wake up as Sleeping Grandma. Bot says, when I want to hibernate, I just take out my batteries. Glass slippers. Would you really want shoes made of glass? It's hard, slippery, and cracks easily. But if a modern-day Cinderella has her heart set on a pair of glass dancing slippers, modern science can grant her wish. The secret is extra tough glass. Glass makers have discovered ways to make stronger glass by quick heating and cooling, or by tweaking the glass's chemical recipe. This toughened or tempered glass is strong and scratch-proof. Some formulas even bend a bit. If it does break, it shatters into small chunks instead of knife-sharp shards. You don't have to go to a ball to see this magical glass. It's all around you every day in car windows, refrigerator shelves, cell phones, and computers. Sisyphus says, sneakers are better for fast escapes. Jumping gems. In the story, Toads and Diamonds, a fairy rewards a kind girl with a spell that makes gems fall from her mouth when she speaks. Her mean sister gets toads. There is an illustration showing this. That's much less work than digging them out of the ground. We still can't pull gems from thin air, but scientists can grow gems in a laboratory. To grow gems, scientists melt the mineral ingredients of the gemstone in a hot furnace or with lasers. Then they let it slowly cool. As it cools, the mineral naturally forms a crystal. Gems were first grown this way in the late 1800s. These gems are identical to natural gems, and alas, nearly as expensive. This big, lumpy sapphire was grown in a lab, but it is a real gem, as shown in the photograph. Elvis says, you don't need a magic spell, just the right words and a story to tell. Lab-grown sapphire is used to make watches, supermarket scanners, and spaceship windows. Sapphire is almost as hard as diamond, and much harder than glass. The illustration shows the young girl talking with gems coming out of her mouth, and she says, you must know some big words. Spinning gold. If you can make gems out of powdered rock, could you ever spin gold out of straw like Rumpelstiltskin? When chemists make sapphire in a lab, they have to start with the ingredients of sapphire, aluminum and oxygen, first. Then they fuse them into sapphire. But unlike sapphire, gold isn't a combination of different materials. It's an element. That means it contains only one kind of atom, gold atoms. And atoms can't be changed except inside stars or nuclear reactors. So it's not really possible to make gold. Instead, the trick is to find it. Where do you start looking? Scientists have discovered gold hiding in some surprising places, like seawater. Chemists estimate there are about 8 million tons of gold dissolved in seawater around the world. Unfortunately, Earth's oceans are huge, so the gold is spread thin. There's only a speck in each ton of water. That means it costs more to get the gold out of the water than the gold is worth. So for now, Rumpelstiltskin remains the king of spinning gold. Puck says, "We're rich," watching Rumpelstiltskin spin his gold. Talk to the animals. There's an illustration where many animals, in and around a tree, are talking to the princess. Where would all these lost princesses be without their kind animal helpers? And how convenient they all speak English. "If you bathe me in milk, I'll carry you across the river," says the frog. "There's a big pot of gold buried under this tree," says the squirrel. "The castle is that way. Hurry, the prince is about to get married," said the bird. The rabbit says, "The queen is secretly plotting to steal your shoes." In the real world, talking to animals isn't quite so easy. Yet. But scientists are making progress. Tiny cameras and microphones have collected thousands of hours of animal conversations. Powerful computer programs, similar to ChatGPT, look for patterns in the animal chatter and map these to possible meanings. Soon, these programs may even let us talk back. But there are still challenges. Many animals communicate with smells, body language, or sounds that humans can't hear. And animals have very different minds. They don't think like people, so they're more likely to be saying, "This is my tree," than giving directions to the castle. There's a photograph of two crows in a tree talking. Crows make different calls to say, "Danger, cat, come here," or "I found food." Humans can learn these calls too. One crow says to the other, "Look out, she's back." And the princess says, "You can't fool me. Crows don't talk." Let down your hair. Poor Rapunzel, imprisoned in a tower, lowers her long braid to let visitors in. But how likely is this? Could hair really hold up a prince? There's an illustration showing the wrong way for Rapunzel to do this and the right way. Surprisingly, yes, and you don't even need any magic. Plain old hair is strong stuff. A single strand can hold 3 ounces, the weight of 4 mice, 100 grams, and an average head has about 120,000 hairs. All those hairs braided together could hold a couple of elephants. A prince, no problem. However, Rapunzel would be wise to tie her braid to the bedpost or a sturdy hook before letting someone climb it, or she'd get a painful hair pull and a very sore neck. She'd also need a shorter tower. Human hair only grows a few feet long at most. The longest hair ever recorded was about 18 feet or 6 meters. That's long for hair, but pretty short for a tower. Super strength. There's an illustration showing a very strong man holding up a big hammer wearing a special belt. Before there were comic book superheroes, lucky adventurers in fairy tales found magic potions, belts of strength, and flying boots to give them superpowers. Alas, science has not found any magic potion that can make you strong or fast. Muscles grow strong by being used. But the human body can get a boost from clever machines. Mechanical exoskeletons are a little like wearing a robot. Small computers sense your movements and power motors in the arms and legs of the suit to match. The suit's motor-driven metal limbs can be much stronger than human muscles, and they never get tired. Some exoskeletons are used in factories to carry heavy loads. Other models can help people with disabilities to walk more easily. That's pretty super. There's a photograph showing robotic suits can help workers lift heavy boxes. Page 12. Up, up, and away. There's an illustration showing a good witch or fairy godmother flying in a bubble, a witch flying on her broom, Peter Pan, Superman, Aladdin, and a unicorn. Airplanes are all very well, but where are our broomsticks and flying suits? Inventors have been tinkering with one-person flying machines for many, many years. It's a challenging problem. It takes a lot of force to lift a person off the ground and into the air. That takes a lot of fuel, which is heavy. So more fuel is needed to lift it up. Plus, there's the discomfort of having a hot engine on your back. But as engines get smaller and fuel gets better, jetpacks are also getting more compact. There's a photograph of a man flying with a jetpack. Early versions looked like small helicopters or flying washing machines. But the most recent jet suits have one thruster on the back and two on each arm for steering. These compact suits only carry enough fuel for 4 minutes of flying. But that's enough to get a rescue worker up onto a ship. One curious engineer has even made a flying carpet, or at least a flying placemat. His mat is made of two sheets of different kinds of plastic. Electricity from a small battery makes the sheets vibrate at slightly different speeds, causing a ripply motion. That can make the light mat swim through the air. Alas, to carry a person, the sheet would have to be the size of a football field. But it might be useful for exploring Mars someday. Marvin says to Plushbottom, who's sitting on what looks like a catapult, "Trust me, it's a great flying machine," as he prepares to send her flying through the air by cutting the rope. There's a wizard holding up a hanger with nothing on the hanger, as shown in the illustration. Invisibility cloak. It's always handy, when sneaking into an ogre's castle, to have a cloak, helmet, or ring of invisibility that lets you walk unseen. You'll be glad to know that scientists are hard at work on this problem. They have invented new materials covered in microscopic antennas that bend light around objects. So far, they've managed to hide very tiny objects from radar, with the device is more like a box than a cloak. Hiding larger objects from mixed colors of visible light is trickier, but the new light-bending materials could coat planes to make them, if not invisible, at least much harder to see. An easier way to go invisible is to camouflage yourself so you look exactly like your background. Some animals are quite good at this. Though it doesn't exist yet, it's possible that some futuristic fabric will be able to change color to exactly match what's behind you, so you seem to disappear. In the photograph, this frog has already mastered the art of being invisible. Ratsputin says to Marvin, "Can I pay with invisible money?" Page 14. My Wand is Broken, art by Rupert Van Wyck. "Shazam! Hocus Pocus Crocus Locus!" shouts the wizard. "Rana Leviosa, drat, my wand is broken," shouts another wizard. "This frog won't turn into a diamond necklace," exclaims the sorceress. Two scientists are watching this. "Hey, scientists, can you fix our magic wands?" "Let me look. I think I see the problem. Reality is interfering with it." "Reality?" "Yes, the way the universe actually works. You see, the problem with turning frogs into diamonds, conjuring gold from thin air, and making things disappear is..." "We need more mandrake?" said the wizard. "No, they're impossible. The universe has rules, you know." "Rules? What rules?" "Well, for one thing, there's always the same amount of matter in the universe. Matter, atoms, the stuff everything is made of, can't be magically created or destroyed. You can only rearrange the atoms you've got. The same goes for energy. You can't get energy from nothing or destroy it, only store it and move it around. That's preposterous. I don't believe it. Yeah, what about when wood burns? The wood vanishes and heat and light appear from nowhere. Let's light a fire in our special cauldron and see. First, weigh the bag and all the air the fire will use. Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. Fire burn and cauldron bubble. When the fire's done, we'll weigh everything that's left. The ashes, the water vapor, and don't forget the smoke. Look at that. They weigh the same. Yep, the log didn't vanish. Atoms in the log and air combined to make ash and smoke. And look at these ash particles. They hold less stored energy than the wood in the log. And guess how much less? Exactly as much as came out as heat and light? It's magic. Even better, it's science. Dragons and Dinosaurs by Meg Moss. Art by Ariane Elsamach. Fairy tales all over the world are full of dragons, giants, and other fantastical, imaginary beasts. Did these stories start out as a way to explain some very old bones? Prehistory mystery. Until very recently, people didn't know very much about what the world was like before humans. The last dinosaurs died 65 million years ago. Humans have only been around for about 2 million years, so no human ever saw a living dinosaur. But our ancestors did find and wonder about dinosaur bones. Ancient people had their own ways of explaining these odd bones. They told stories about dragons, sea monsters, and other amazing creatures. Ratsputin says, "Is it a unicorn?" Marvin says, "Manticore? An Avery ice cream fairy?" All looking at something sticking up out of the ground. One of these was the griffin, a cross between a lion and an eagle, rumored to live in the deserts of China. People from Asia to Rome told stories about griffins, each a little different, but all with gigantic beaks, claws, wings, and cat-like bodies. Now, take a look at the skull of a small dinosaur we call Protoceratops. They lived in the Gobi Desert, northern China, about 80 million years ago. Protoceratops had a huge bird-like beak for chewing plants, a bony crest on its head, and bumps on its cheeks gave its skull a monstrous look. It's easy to see how ancient people who found these skulls might imagine that they came from a giant lion-like bird, griffins. There's a photograph of a skull. When you look at its skull, it's easy to see why people once thought Protoceratops was a fantastic bird-like creature. There's a modern reconstruction of the real Protoceratops, and the caption reads, "Just call me Griffinoceratops." There's also a photograph captioned, "Mammoth skulls might have inspired stories of one-eyed, long-toothed giants, ogres, and cyclops." The Terrible Lizards. In the 1800s, scientists began to realize that ancient fossils belonged to long extinct animals, not mythical beasts. But what did these animals really look like? The task of assembling the bones in the proper order and figuring out how they moved was quite a challenge. Pretend for a moment that you have never seen a bicycle before. You have no idea what it does or how it is used. Now suppose you stumble upon a funny-looking, triangular, cushioned thing sticking out of the earth. Next to it lies a curved metal bar with plastic ends. Farther along, a hoop of rubber. What could these things be? Are they parts of a single machine? Are they like any machine you know? How do they fit together? How many pieces are missing? This gives you an idea of the questions scientists ask when they find dinosaur bones. In the 1840s, English scientist Richard Owen started calling these ancient fossil animals dinosaurs, from the Greek for terrible lizard. He thought the bones resembled modern reptiles. There's some illustrations of scientists trying to figure out how the bones go together. It's a lizard, so its legs must be on the side. Sounds good to me. Those guys had it all wrong. The legs go underneath. Marvin is inside a dinosaur costume and says, like this? Iguanodon was among the first dinosaurs to be studied. Its discoverer, Gideon Mantell, imagined a creature like a huge iguana with legs sprawled out to the side. Mantell's wife discovered a large, pointed bit, which he decided was the creature's nose horn. Over the years, scientists have changed their minds many times about the iguanodon. Today, we think that its legs were more like a mammal's and that it could walk on either two legs or four. That spiky horn is actually a long, sharp toenail. The headless giant. Today we know of more than 1,000 species of dinosaurs, and more are discovered every year. Paleontologists, scientists who study fossils, have a tough job keeping up with all the bones. When a fossil is discovered, it is often difficult to know what animal the bones belong to. Is it a new dinosaur or one we already know about? And when the bones of more than one creature are jumbled together, scientists must be extra careful. Take the case of poor old Apatosaurus, whose name means deceptive lizard. Now there's a dinosaur with an identity crisis. This huge 30-ton creature was first discovered and named in 1877. 2 years later, the same scientist examined another set of bones and gave them the name Brontosaurus, or Thunder Lizard. There's an illustration of the iguanodon walking on four legs and holding its tail out. Then, in 1974, scientists decided that Brontosaurus was really just another Apatosaurus, that there was no Brontosaurus after all. Now, scientists once again think that they are different species, so Brontosaurus is back. Apatosaurus also spent many years with the wrong head. The first Apatosaurus skeleton did not have a skull. So, for almost 100 years, no one was sure what its head looked like. Museums all over the world showed it headless, or stuck on the head of another dinosaur. Finally, a single, true Apatosaurus skull was found in a museum basement, and Apatosaurus could finally hold its head up proudly. There's an illustration, and the caption reads, "Up, down, or sideways. Early drawings of long-necked sauropods often showed them with their heads held high like a giraffe, tails dragging on the ground. But new studies of sauropod neck bones, helped by computer models, suggest that these giants probably held their necks and tails more in a straight line for balance. They might rear up to munch high branches, but thick muscles meant that their necks probably weren't very bendy. When the first sauropods were found, some scientists thought the huge animals must have lived in the water to help support their massive weight. But now they are pretty sure sauropods lived only on land. Their bones were strong enough for walking. Tracks of sauropod herds have been found on dry land, not in swamps, and the water pressure pushing in on such a huge body would have made it difficult for the animals to breathe, even if their heads were above the water." There's an illustration at the bottom of the page. Since the first sauropod dinosaur was found, scientists have changed their minds many times about how these animals moved. Now they're pretty sure sauropods held their necks and tails straight, but whether they were spotted or striped is anyone's guess. The lost trumpet. Computers are a big help to paleontologists, allowing them to fit skeletons together in different ways, without having to move around actual bones. They can even help scientists hear what dinosaurs might have sounded like. In the illustration, one scientist leans against the bone and says, "Sounds like a tuba." Another says, "No, a trombone, definitely a trombone." Parasaurolophus had a large hollow crest extending off the back of its head. Was it a weapon, or a snorkel, or how about a trombone? Computer scientists took scans of a Parasaurolophus skull with special equipment that could see inside. They found that the crest was hollow, filled with long tubes and chambers. They used scans to make a 3D computer model of the head. When the computer recreated the sound of air blowing through the tubes, the scientists heard an eerie, deep, rumbling tone, a sound not heard on Earth for 75 million years. That's the kind of bedtime song paleontologists like the best. There's an illustration of a Parasaurolophus at the bottom of page 21. Snorkel, weapon, noisemaker? Parasaurolophus's curious crest had scientists guessing. They now think it was used to make a booming trumpet call. Avery is playing what looks like a clarinet, and Watson says, "Now that's what I call old-time music." In the photograph, the caption reads, "This computer image shows the complicated tubes and chambers inside a Parasaurolophus crest." Page 22. Could dragons exist? Art by Emily Feigenschuh. What's that up in the sky? The air fills with a rushing sound as a huge, scaly shape with a long tail swoops overhead on outspread wings, breathing fire. Dragon! Then you wake up. Alas, dragons don't really exist. But could they? What would it take to make a real dragon? What makes a dragon? In stories, dragons are as large as dinosaurs, with claws like eagles, tough, scaly hides like alligators, spiky crests, and tails like lizards, and wings like bats. In fact, many dragon parts are found in nature, just not all in a single animal. Scaly hide. Many dragon features are borrowed from lizards, alligators, and other reptiles. Their armor-like skin, for one. Tough alligator hide resists bites and cuts, heals quickly, and can even repel bullets. Huge size. Fairy tale dragons are often huge, but so were dinosaurs. In fact, dinosaur bones found in rocks might have inspired the first dragon stories. Wings. For an animal to fly, its wings have to be big enough to support its weight in the air. But at a certain size, big wings weigh more than they can lift. The largest creature ever to fly was a prehistoric giraffe-sized pterosaur with 15-foot, 5-meter wings. Scientists think that's about as big as a flying animal can get. Thick or thin bones. Birds have hollow bones to keep their bodies light for flying, but delicate bones would not be strong enough to support a big, muscly reptile body covered in scaly armor. Floating gas? What if dragons had a special sac inside filled with hydrogen or other light gas to help them float? That's an interesting idea, but no other flying creature has figured out how to do this, and hydrogen is quite explosive. Spines and spikes. Dragon-like spines and tail spikes can be seen on many modern lizards and on ancient dinosaurs. Four legs and wings. Plenty of animals have four legs, and plenty have wings, but none have four legs and wings. Why not? Because the wings of flying animals evolved from front legs. An animal with four legs and wings would need to have had a sixth-legged ancestor. And no six-legged vertebrates, animals with bones, have ever existed on Earth. Breathing fire. A dragon would need a store of fuel and some way to ignite it. Some rocks make flammable gas when dissolved in acid, so dragons might be able to make fuel by digesting rocks. They could get sparks from body electricity, like an electric eel, or by carrying sparkling stones in their teeth. But fire is dangerous, especially if you're full of fuel. One spark down the throat and they'd explode. Maybe that's why no real animal has ever used fire as a defense. Zia throws some food at the dragon and says, "Just lightly browned, please." spitting acid. The closest thing to real dragon fire may be the spray of the tiny bombardier beetle. When attacked, it squirts two chemicals that combine in the air to form a boiling hot acid. It's not fire, but it's pretty effective. So the next time you're out hunting dragons, look around. They're everywhere. The Poisoned Apple. In the story Snow White, the jealous queen decides to get rid of Snow White once and for all with an apple dipped in deadly poison. Thanks to some helpful dwarves and a handsome prince, Snow White recovers and everyone lives happily ever after. But the queen didn't know to go to all that trouble. In fact, apples, along with many common fruits we eat, are already poisonous. But don't panic. The yummy, fleshy part won't harm you. It's only the seeds you need to avoid. Apple trees belong to a plant family called Prunus. This group also includes peaches, plums, apricots, and cherries. The seeds and pits of all these fruits contain a chemical called amygdalin. Inside an animal's stomach, amygdalin turns into a strong poison called cyanide. And cyanide can make people and animals very sick or even kill them. Still, don't worry if you accidentally swallow a few apple seeds. Each seed has only a very tiny amount of poison. You'd have to eat a large bowl full of seeds to feel any effect, and you'd need to chew them well. The hard, shiny shells of apple seeds keep the poison locked inside. Unchewed seeds usually pass right through and come out whole in your poop. But cows and other animals often chew up seeds along with the fruit, so they can get sick from eating apples and plums that fall to the ground. Why would a tree make poisoned seeds? To stop animals from nibbling on them. Amygdalin tastes terrible. It's also found in leaves and other parts of fruit trees. If a deer or cow munches on apple leaves, it gets a nasty taste and an upset stomach. Animals soon learn to leave those trees alone. Thanks, amygdalin. Want proof? If you bite into an apple seed, you'll notice an awful taste. Gross. That's amygdalin. The apple tree doesn't want you to chew up its seeds. It wants you to spit them out so they can grow into new trees. Go right ahead. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the cleverest fruit of all? You, my apple. Marvin says, see, fruits and vegetables are bad for you. Watson says, only if you get them from a villain. And Avery says, I'll never trust a tree again. Jack and the Giant Kudzu by Pamela Dell, art by Sarjo Frieden. The story of a cow, a farmer, and some magic beans. Many years ago, let's say around the year 1937, a young man, let's call him Jack, gazed out across his farm in the heart of Georgia. The pastures were looking weedy and thin. Jack's cows were down to their last blades of grass. The soil was blowing away in the wind. Jack frowned. His farm was in big trouble. So Jack set off for town in hopes of finding a solution. On the way, he met a traveling salesman in a fancy suit, beaming a wide salesman's smile. Hold up there, young fella, the salesman said. Why so glum? My name is Channing Cope. Maybe I can help. Jack told his woes to the salesman. I'm at my wit's end, Jack sighed. Ever heard of kudzu? Cope asked, a gleam in his eye. Jack shook his head. The word rhymed with mudzu. It's the newest miracle plant straight from Japan, Cope exclaimed, and it's going to save the South. Jack was doubtful. He did not believe in miracles. I kid you not, Cope gushed on. Why, this little miracle vine will feed your livestock and stop your soil erosion. No sweat. It's perfectly natural, related to beans. Grows anywhere. Never needs water. Cows love it. It pulls nitrogen from the air into the soil so other crops grow better. You can use it for medicine, make paper out of it. Heck, you can even cook it up and eat it. Plant kudzu, my boy, and your worries are over. Jack thought Cope's claims were a bit outrageous, but he was desperate. So he traded Cope his last dollar for a handful of big fat beans. When he got home, his wife was furious. "You spent our hard-earned money on a miracle vine?" she shouted. That salesman sure knew a fool when he met one. She grabbed the beans, flung them out of the window, and stomped off, the skinny cow's mood sadly. A few days later, Jack was shocked to see his pasture covered with green. A tangle of thick vines with purple flowers spread in every direction. The cows munched at it ravenously. "Hooray!" Jack shouted as he raced back to the house. "The miracle vine worked. Our troubles are over." The next day, the kudzu vines covered the whole pasture a foot deep. "It's amazing," Jack said happily. "It grows so quickly." In the cartoon, Plush Potum says, "My garden has too many aphids." And Marvin says, "You need some ladybugs." "Now there are too many ladybugs," Plush Potum says. Marvin says, "Some frogs will take care of that." 2 days later, the kudzu had covered every field around Jack's house and had scaled the roof too. Thought Jack. "Wow, it really does spread, doesn't it?" It certainly did. In 2 weeks, the vicious vine infested the neighbor's land, traveled up telephone poles, and covered every tree in sight. The smothered trees began to wilt and die. Jack and his wife had to shut their windows at night to keep the kudzu from growing into the house as they slept. Uh-oh, Jack thought. Jack tried everything he could think of to stop the monstrous vines. He tried hacking them to bits. He burned them and poured weed killer on them. He tried ripping them out by the roots, but the roots were so deep it was hard to get them all. The vines always grew back. And how does the story end? Well, it doesn't. To this very day, Jack is still trying to cut down the beanstalk. Moral: be careful what you wish for. Note: this is no fairy tale, as shown in the photograph. It's a true story. Originally sold as a miracle crop, kudzu has become an invasive species that's a giant menace over much of the southern United States. And as the climate warms, it's spreading north. No one has yet found a way to get rid of it for good. Those pesky vines just keep coming back. And the vine lived happily ever after. In the cartoon, Plush Bottom says, "Now what?" as she's covered with frogs. "Oops, gotta go," said Marvin. Page 29. Ask with Sage and Briar. Text by Ellen R. Braff. Art by Marnie Galloway. Roman W. wants to know, why can't metal go in the microwave? Sage says, microwave ovens heat food in a different way from normal ovens. At the back of the oven, a part called a magnetron sends out powerful bursts of short radio waves called microwaves, as shown in the illustration. Smooth metal walls bounce microwaves around inside. When these waves pass through food, they cause water and fat molecules to flip and spin around. All that jiggling creates heat, so the food cooks itself. So why no metal? Asks Briar. Metal has no water in it, but it does have lots of loose electrons that move around between atoms. When microwaves hit metal objects or foil, they cause electrons to flow and bunch up. Energy and heat builds up fast, especially on the metal's pointy places. All that energy needs a place to go. Yes, so it sparks. That could start a fire, burn a pit in the metal, or fry the microwave's electric system instead of the food, adds Briar. but microwave ovens are made of metal. Smooth metal walls act a bit differently. Microwaves reflect off them, bouncing around inside. Even the window has a metal mesh to bounce waves, so they don't accidentally heat you too. The teeny holes in my metal screen keep the microwaves inside the oven, but let the smaller light waves pass through so you can see inside. Breyer asks, so how long should I wave cook this fish? About 2.5 minutes, says Sage. Ask us anything. Write to us at ASK, 1 East Erie Street, Suite 525, PMB 4136, Chicago, Illinois, 60611, or have your parent email ask@cricketmedia.com. On page 32, there's a contest which you can do with your parent, teacher, or guardian. That's it for the November-December edition of ASK, Science and Exploration for Curious Kids. I'm Chris, radio volunteer, Ron Pariser.